I hate losing Colin. But his wife was killed in a traffic accident while she was downside, arranging for their children to change fosterage. It's going to take him quite a while to sort everything out. You'll find we have good teams, Lieutenant, and a tour on an SAR is always interesting. We deal with problems that the big boys ignore, everything from private yachts stranded by jump drive blowouts to collisions. You will learn a lot. And since we didn't expect you until tomorrow, you're not on the watch list yet, which gives you time to poke around and start learning your job.
All I've had was the basic SAR course, sir. They assigned me before I had time for the advanced.
Better than nothing. And if you know you don't know, you'll ask questions instead of blundering around causing trouble. Now, the duties of exec on this ship are different than on line ships. That's because our mission is different. There's the basic stuff, of course. But I'd like you to look at this.
He handed over a data cube.
And of course, you'll want to meet everyone. We'd planned a get-together this evening at 1900.
That's fine, sir. I can get unpacked and have a chance to look this over. Unless you have something now.
No, that's fine. We're not kicking out of here until day after tomorrow anyway. There's a meeting tomorrow, which you'll have to attend as my representative. You haven't been with the ship quite long enough to take over full prep.
Alone in her cabin, her name was already on the door, she noticed, with the permanent engraving Executive Officer underneath. She inserted the cube the captain had given her into the reader. She knew what an exec did, or thought she did. Run the ship, basically, under the captain's command. But on a search and rescue ship, the exec also had the responsibility of supervising all rescue efforts, while the captain concentrated on ship security, of both this ship and the rescued one. She blinked at the listing for the security detachments. She had not realized that an SAR ship would carry Marines, though it made sense. Most of the time, when the ships needed rescue, it was the result of some deliberate act, and the troublemakers might still be in the area. And she'd had only the basic course, so it was definitely going to be a case of Sergeant put up that flagpole if they had a rescue call before she had learned the rest of the stuff she needed, which meant she had better make friends with the Sergeant equivalents. She scrolled quickly through the headings of her job description to the ship's table of organization and began to figure out who would do the actual work while she supervised. Shrike mounted two complete rescue teams, cross-trained in both gravity field and zero-gravity work. Like most of the smaller SARs, the gravity field training specialized in low-pressure and vacuum work. Most of their calls would be to space stations or ships in deep space. A forensic team and a lab full of analytical gear suggested that SAR might include something more than accident assistance. And the medical support team was substantially larger than a ship this size normally carried, including both major trauma regen tanks and two surgical theaters, with all that implied. Again, it reminded her of a miniature of Kosciuszko. Rescue 1 was commanded by a lieutenant she remembered from the academy as a clown of sorts, Tika Briados. He didn't seem clownish now, as he led her around the ready room with its racked suits and equipment. It all seemed a jumble to Esme, though an orderly one. She recognized only about half the equipment and wondered how long it would take to learn the rest. Rescue 2's commander was a jig she'd never met before, Kim Arik. She was eager and energetic, busily explaining things that Esme hoped she could remember. She kept nodding and found herself liking Jig Arik for her single-minded enthusiasm. Going through both rescue team areas had taken hours, she found when she finally got away from Arik, and she needed to get ready for the meeting with the other officers. She did hope they weren't all going to mention Brun Meager. The wardroom was crowded when she got there. The blocky major who thrust out his hand reminded her of Major Patak.
Lieutenant Sweezer, glad to meet you. I'm Gordon Bannon, pathology.
Captain Solis stood.
Officers, this is Lieutenant Esme Sweezer, our new executive officer. Some of you have heard of her. She's fresh out of Copper Mountain with the basic course in SAR, so I'm sure you'll all cooperate in educating her about the real world.
After that, the others came up one by one to introduce themselves. Esme began to relax as she chatted with them. They were clearly more interested in how she might perform here than in anything which had happened in her past. In the next few days, Esme threw herself into her work, loading her scheduler with everything she could think of, or that anyone suggested. When Shrike left the base, she was just beginning to think she had a handle on her assignments. Shrike would patrol alone through the sector, ready to assist in any emergency that fell within its mission statement. According to those who had been aboard longest, days might go by with nothing happening, or disasters might overlap. There was no way to predict.
The ship's a part container, part bulk hauler that lost power on insertion. The in-system drive's functioning at maybe 20%. They say it's fluctuating and they can't make orbit. We've advised them that there's a registered salvage company in this system. The captain sounds unhappy with that. Says he's had trouble before with salvage companies.
The first emergency since she'd come aboard. Esme listened to the précis of the problem and tried to remember which protocol this fell under.
He wants fleet assistance. We have a responsibility in such cases, but we must also consider our responsibility to the whole area. So I want an estimate on the time it will take us to skip jump over there, rig grapples and put him in tow, then sling him back toward the orbit he wants. He's not an emergency.
Esme ran the numbers quickly.
Sir, 60 hours, allowing a safety margin for rigging the grapples. He should have standard tug connections, but just in case.
Well then, let's go catch us a freighter.
Esme watched the approach plots carefully on the bridge displays. External vid showed a bulbous, almost spherical ship with rings of colored light indicating tug grapple connections. Lieutenant Briados, the Rescue One commander, was on the bridge to watch the approach.
Ugly, isn't it? You'd think they could design big freighters with some character, but they all look pretty much alike.
It would hold a lot of soldiers.
I can tell you're off a warship. Yeah, it could, but it hasn't got in-system maneuverability worth spit, even with the in-system drive working.
All right, Sweeza, let's see how you handle this. Just pretend you've been doing it for years.
Her stomach churned. She nodded to the comm watch and picked up the headset to talk to the freighter captain, explaining that a team would be boarding.
We just wanted a tow. I don't see why you want to board.
It's RSS policy to board all vessels seeking assistance. Just routine, sir.
Damn nuisance.
Think of it as practice. If we didn't practice close hauling and boarding, we might not be quick enough for someone with a serious emergency. After all, it might be your ship.
Oh, all right. Just as long as you're not planning to practice cutting holes in my hull.
Shrike deployed standard tug grapples, backed up by its military-grade tractor. In this instance, the grapples homed neatly on the freighter's signal and locked on as Shrike maintained matching course and velocity. The tractor snugged the SAR ship closer still. Esme gave the orders that sent Jig Arik and her team across a few hundred meters of vacuum to the other ship. Rescue 2 made its way in and out of the holds, while Shrike boosted the freighter gently on its way, then returned before Solas ordered the grapples retracted.
Captain, what were they looking for?
Just practicing.
She looked at him. Finally, he grinned at her.
All right, you might as well know. Sector's concerned about possible shortages in the munitions inventory. We think some stuff's being diverted from fleet to civilian use. So the Admiral says to check every ship that asks us for a boost. It is good practice, including the use of the warhead detection equipment.
What's missing?
I've been told I don't need to know, but since they specified the equipment we were to use looking for it, I'd say someone's misplaced some of the more effective nukes.
Ouch.
Exactly. If our stuff's being transshipped on civilian freighters, it could be going anywhere, to anyone. Probably not the Benignity. They have their own munitions industry and plenty in stock. But any of the lesser hostile powers or domestic malcontents...
Or simply pirates.
Yes. Anyone who wants a big bang.
The freighter Elias Madero, owned by the Boros Consortium, followed a five-angled route that had proved lucrative for decades. Olives and wine from Bizarre, jewels mined on Oddlink, livestock embryos from Gollum, commercial-grade organics from Podge, entertainment cubes from Corian, which had FTL traffic from deeper in-system, and the largest population in the area. She was a container hauler, picking up at each port the hold-shaped containers that had been filling since her last visit there. Her crew, most of them permanent, often had no idea what was in the containers. The captain did, presumably, and also the Boros agents at each port. But the containers had no accessible hatches. One advantage of container ships was supposed to be the impossibility of petty pilfering by crews, So they had no idea that the container in hold 5, which was supposed to be filled with 5,832 cube players, was actually full of arms stolen from a fleet stockpile. The other containers in hold 5, which should have had entertainment cubes to be played in the cube players, contained more illicit weaponry, including 34 Whitsock 43B11 warheads, their controlling electronics, and the arming keys. Boros' agent at Bizarre would not have been happy to find the contents of that container, since she had a contract to supply the cube players and the entertainment cubes supposedly filling the rest of Hold 5. Elias Madero came out of FTL flight, retranslating to normal space, to traverse the real space distance between two jump points in the same system, colloquially known as Two-Bits. This shortcut had been marked questionable on standard charts for years, because the presence of two jump points in the same system was believed, on theoretical grounds, to lead to spatial instability of the jump points. If the insertion point shifted, an inbound ship might find itself emerging too close to a large mass, with no time to maneuver clear. But the nearest green-lined route meant three more jump point calculations and added 11 days to the Corian-Bizarre passage. Since jump point temporal coordinates were fuzzy anyway, many commercial haulers used shortcuts to ensure that they met contractual delivery dates, while filing flight plans that were all green-lined. This crew had made the traverse before many times without incident. The jump points had not shifted in the past 50 years, while the possibility that they might kept the system uncrowded. On this trip, system insertion went as smoothly as usual, and the Elias transferred to in-system drive without a hitch. Captain Lund turned to his navigation officer, a transfer from Sorius Madero, a sister ship, and clapped a hand on the man's shoulder.
That's done then. 4 days and we'll be out of here again. I'm going to bed.
Custom and regulation both required that a captain be on the bridge during jump point insertions. Lund had been up 3 shifts running because of a minor engineering problem.
I have the course laid, sir. By my calculations, 97.2 hours.
Very good.
Captain Lund, balding and stocky, waited until he was in his cabin to take off his jacket and kick off his shoes. He hung the jacket up neatly, set his shoes side by side, laid his trousers neatly folded over the back of his chair, with his shirt over them. This was his last cycle. When he reached Corian again, he would retire at last. Helen, his grandchildren, the neat little house set high on a slope above the valley. He drifted into sleep, a smile on his face.